Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Dobrý večer from Prague, and welcome to the Bohemican Podcast. I'm Pete Coleman.
And I'm Travis Dow from the History of Alchemy Podcast.
Tonight, we are introducing the podcast version of my blog called Bohemican.com. We will look at we will have you break out the map of the Czech Republic tonight and bring you up to date on history, legends, culture, and traditions from all across Bohemia. I had recently made Prague my home, and this is my first 2 years here. I've really traveled the rails and the roadways throughout this great republic, from Ostrava to Šumava, from Pilsen to Brno. The Bohemican Podcast will introduce you to this wonderful region of Central Europe.
If you love history, you'll love this show. We try to concentrate more on the overlooked parts of history, maybe something that not everybody knows, at least if you didn't grow up in this part. And there's a lot of, you know, good stuff there. We'll talk about not just straight history, but also some of the famous kind of legends and traditions. But they'll all have some basis in history somehow.
I think what will make this podcast special and really stand out on its own is the fact that this is going to be from the viewpoints of two expat Americans that have decided to make Prague and the Czech Republic their home, thus the name Bohemican, as in Bohemian American.
Yeah.
All right. Tonight we'll focus on the Czech capital of Praha, better known as Prague, but with a twist. We will skirt past the throngs of tourists in Old Town and take you to the hidden subterranean world of the medieval Prague underground tunnels. A great example of the history people might not know is that Prague has an extensive underground, not catacombs like in Paris, but a whole city with streets and houses and even Cold War bunkers. We're not just talking subways either. Prague has an underground city of its own. You're walking on the streets of Old Town, and you're walking over an entire other city that is often forgotten.
Yeah, I mean, so if you go far enough back, like let's say definitely 11th century, that there's a whole underground kind of city, and especially around Old Town Square, that used to be the street level. So there's like living quarters down there, streets, everything. I mean, you can still make out the front doors, everything. But it's pretty flown to pr- to pretty. Sorry. Okay. It's pretty.
You have to start again from the top.
Okay, hold on.
Yeah.
However, Prague is pretty prone to flooding, so they raise basically the whole city, what is now Old Town, up a level, up a floor, sometimes even up to like 2.5 floors. And if you're walking around, especially Old Town Square, you can still see it. So if you peek in some of the windows, you have to know which ones, but you can really see it's just, it's far down there. It's, you know, what would be the roof of a two-story house is underground. So yeah, it's pretty impressive. The thing is, it's kind of, I don't know if some of our listeners have been to Seattle or maybe are from Seattle. It's the same idea. So Seattle was really prone to flooding, and so they raised the whole city a street level, and then the underground kind of had this festering, you know, underground culture, you know, prostitution and gambling and, you know, illegal gambling activities, black market, everything. So the same thing happened here. The interesting thing is that now it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. You know, think of the astrological clock in Prague, the old town hall. But once that became the underground, those became torture chambers. I mean, for centuries, people were tortured there. And I used to be a tour guide down there, so I've been down there hundreds of times. And it's interesting because you can make out someone's living room. Like it's, you know, finely carved stone, and then you step out, and it's on it's like a street. Even That's though it's amazing. All blocked off, it's, yeah. You know, it's cobblestone. So, like... It was built up in the 14th century, around the time of Charles IV. So underneath, it's like, you know, let's say 11th century, 12th century cobblestones, and it's just a city under a city. There's wells that still have water in them. There's open pits. You know, it's a dangerous place. It was a dangerous place. Now it's kind of you know, you kind of got to watch your step. But yeah, I mean, there's for centuries when it was, you know, even during the time when it was a, you know, some of those rooms were torture chambers, it was really a labyrinth. And the thing is that if you were doing some kind of black market activity or whatever, I mean, it was a dangerous place, the underground, right? Like, there would be open pits, like I mentioned, open wells. There'd be booby traps, like, you know, for invading armies, all kinds of things. Not to mention sewage, so you could go down there and get things like cholera and, you know, strange diseases. But if you were doing black market activities, escaping to the underground might still be the better option, because if you get caught doing some bad thing, you might end up in some of those torture chambers. And, yeah, that's not good.
But I would think it would be a little bit different than getting caught by Interpol today. You'd have a fighting chance. I think back then, in the Middle Ages, to get caught in doing something wrong or against local mandates would get you not only death, unfortunately, probably get you torture before death.
Yeah.
That was pretty much the flow of what happened underneath these streets of Prague, especially in Old Town. But I got to ask you, Travis, real quickly, giving tours and talking to tourist and making this actually a tourist trap, no pun intended, where instead of getting cholera, you might get a t-shirt. Who knows?
Yeah.
But back in the day, with all these horrible things that happened, there's got to be some really weird feelings being down there. Maybe feeling some bad echoes of the past.
Yeah, it's a creepy place, and it's interesting because I got to the point where I've been down there so often that if all the lights went out, I'd be able to find. I mean, it's a maze. It's you know, everything's uneven, but I've been down there so often that I know exactly where the steps are. I know where everything is. However, it's creepy. Like, there's graffiti down there, like etched into the stone. One thing that really struck me was, like I said, Václav a couple of times, which is a really common Czech name. Martin, there's dates down there, like 1609. There's the executioner's symbol, like two crossed axes, kind of, you know, etched right into the doorway there. And there's It's kind of gory, so for our more sensitive listeners, maybe skip a couple minutes here. But and I don't know how much we want to get into the torture, but it was gruesome.
I think we do need to talk about it because Prague, as many people have told us, and may probably have told you, when you moved to Prague as an American, and a lot of us unfortunately don't have the knowledge of Central Europe taught to us at a young age in the States, this was a learning curve for me. And yeah. People would say Prague is an absolutely amazing city, and it is. But it's the best and worst of European history.
Yeah.
It's the best as in Baroque architecture. It's the best of some great musical composers have composed some beautiful things here. Artwork, just the ideas of the Renaissance had flourished here in some parts. But I would tell you, though, it's also the some of the worst.
Yeah, but it had a dark side.
It had a
right.
dark side. It had a dark
yeah.
side. And during the course of this show, these weeks ahead of us, we will be talking about some of those dark sides.
Mm-hmm.
The very beginning of the Czech people, we'll be talking about the Middle Ages. We'll be talking about the Reformation and how that worked out for everybody.
Countless wars.
Not
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
We'll be talking about the Nazi occupation. We'll be talking about communism.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of rough things going here, but when we get back to the idea of the dark side of Prague, this really will make the hair on your arm stand up. When you talk about torture, and
yeah.
that there was no hope
There's,
for you if you got caught and put down in these tunnels.
Yeah, I would say the hopelessness, that's kind of that's a key, let's say, emotion. I mean, it's, yeah, you know that it's the end. Going down there was a death sentence. It's how you would die.
Or how long it would take for you to die.
How long it would take.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple of stories we'll get into where, you know, they were tortured for a while. But to give you more of a picture of what's actually there right now, like I said, you know, it's the cobblestones. You can tell that it was a street at some point. But when the communists just kind of used those chambers as storage, because it's right underneath the old town hall. It's a UNESCO site, like I mentioned, and it's right underneath the clock tower. It's kind of the foundation of the clock tower. Like one of the rooms is the bottom of the clock tower.
If I could stop you for real quick, Travis, when visitors visit Prague, you can't miss it.
This is the thing they see. Yeah. The clock.
They see the clock tower, and people around the top of every hour gather around the clock tower that still works today.
So imagine.
And that's a whole other story for another show.
Yeah, but beneath their feet is
history of horrors.
Well, yeah. So the interesting thing is anywhere you walk, a lot of it's not excavated. But to give you a specific example, in the 90s when the communists left, they cleared out all the storage stuff. And there was one of the pits. When they cleared it out, they started finding human bones. And they're still there. They excavated them. But I mean, when I say they're still there, I'm not talking Paris catacombs. I mean, they're sitting around in cardboard boxes. So if you go on those tours, you can just, you know, you see them. They're just put aside in one of the rooms.
So nobody decided to make a memorial to these folks, or basically
at least not yet. I mean, I think it's all kind of a work in progress. It's hard to say. Like sometimes in the daytime, there's art galleries down there. So it's they kind of ignore that dark past and just walk right by the graffiti. But this one particular pit. In fact, you can watch it. I don't want to plug the show. We're not getting anything out of this. But if you watch, I think it's called Most Haunted Live or something. It's the British version.
British version of the show.
And they go down there. In fact, they sit in that pit in pitch blackness with just a webcam. And I'll
tell
you.
Sounds like fun, like a good Saturday night.
Yeah. When I was down there, I was down there a bunch of times, not afraid of the place. Even if the lights went out, I would know exactly where the exit was. I wouldn't even worry about it. But there's a couple of creepy things, and one of them is that pit. Like, after about the 50th time, I noticed that subconsciously, I didn't look down there. Like, it's just a weird vibe. And that's where they found the bones. And there's some 3,000 bones sitting in cardboard boxes.
3,000 bones. So we're talking many, many people at this point.
Well, yeah. Okay. The interesting thing is that if you do the math, you think, well, there's 200 bones, something in the human body.
So you think there's
15 people? No, because there's far more skulls than that. And the thing is, to get into one of the stories, and I'll tell you, like,
Let's say there's like 10 rooms down there. They know which one was a kitchen at one point. They know which one was kind of the entryway. They don't know for sure which ones were torture chambers and which ones weren't. They just know that torture did happen in some of those rooms. There's the graffiti in one of the rooms that might give something away. And the room with the pit in it is right next to it. And so the thing is, you think, okay, 3,000 bones, 15 people. No. Because what we do have written record of is some of the guards like to play a game. And so, like I said, when you get sent down there, it's a death sentence. They don't care about what happens to you next. So what the guards would do was, there's all kinds of torture devices. We can get into that. But in this particular pit, what they would do is they'd throw a couple of guys down there and, let them starve a couple of days. And then they'd give them one little tiny slice or kind of a rind of a piece of bread and drop it down the hole and watch them fight for it. And some of them, just by dropping them down there, they might get a broken foot or a broken leg or something, so they're not doing too well. And so they'd place bets, who's going to get the bread today, right? So they'd fight over this, and the prisoner that got the bread, that soldier would win. Well, now it's pitch black down there. And what do you think happens when, after a couple of days, sooner or later, one of them's going to starve to death? Pitch black, fresh, warm corpse. What do you think happens when that guy dies,
It becomes a survival issue.
Yeah. They got cannibalized. Now, when I say 3,000 bones, the thing is they didn't find any small bones. Like, there's no, pinky finger bones. Those are just gone. I don't know if they're dissolved over time, possibly digested, crunched up, who knows. But all the medium-sized bones, like let's say rib bones, they were all broken in half, probably to get to the marrow. And all 3,000 bones, including jaw bones, skull bones, all of them had human teeth marks on them.
So that's the proof of cannibalism.
So it's, yeah.
A lot of
with the written records of the game, and then, finding those bones, that's pretty good evidence. We do know some more concrete stories of some of the people that were down there.
One of the stories that I've heard being here was the one of one of the most famous inmates in some of these chambers was Jan Zaleski of the Hussite Wars.
Yep.
And he was kept down there for some 3 years.
Yeah.
Jan Zaleski was a radical priest that led a procession through Prague that ended in the first defenestration in 1419, if we can go back that far.
Well, okay. Imagine 3 years, first of all.
Yeah,
if you
can make that. I don't know if you lose your mind.
Second, what the heck's a defenestration?
Okay, well, the defenestration, this is one of the things that you learn when you come through as a tourist, because the defenestration, the first and second defenestration, had huge ramifications for Europe and what was coming up as the Reformation between the Protestants and the Catholics.
Yeah.
Right?
And not just Bohemia. I mean, it was,
Well, it started here.
Yep.
It started here in Prague, and it set in motion a chain of events where millions of lives were changed and lost.
Yeah.
And the course of one of the more prominent religions on the planet had to adapt and change.
Define the word. What are we talking about?
Being thrown from the window.
That's right.
Basically, is what happens.
There's a word for that. Yeah,
there's a word for that. The difference in Czech and English is sometimes immense, and sometimes there's things that don't translate here. That's something you learn as an expat living in Czech Republic.
But it is a key word. It's central to.
I've been actually in the room in Prague Castle where they actually tossed the guy right out the window.
And that is first or second?
That would be the second.
Yeah, okay.
That would be the second one. So, I'll give it to you. I'll hand it over to you.
Yeah, so the first one was 1419. You mentioned Hussite Wars. We're not going to get into that because I guess that'll be a future episode.
That's too much right now.
That's fascinating stuff. Yeah. The second one had wide-leading consequences. There was kind of that started an uprising, which ended in the Battle of White Mountain, which in turn kind of some turn of events which started the 30 Years' War. But the reason we bring up that one is because the leader of that rebellion was a man named Jan Jasinski, or we kind of know him by his Latin name, Jan Jasinius. And he's famous. He was a professor of medicine in Charles University. He did the first public autopsy, which the Catholics frowned upon, but he was Protestant, which is it's important in the story. These are like reformers, kind of. So, yeah, him and his 26 compatriots ended up in those same torture rooms, the torture chambers, you know, underneath the old town, underneath the old town hall.
And this is, just for our listeners, this is a historical consequence to the uprising and the battle, the lost battle of the Protestants at the Battle of Bilahora, which is White Mountain in English, which is just actually inside Prague now, near Prague 6, in the district that we call Prague 6 today, to the northwest a little bit. It is a very famous battle. Some, they say 30 to 40,000 combatants combined, 7,000 or so killed, but mainly the
In hours.
And basically the end story is the Protestants lost, and therefore Bohemia was taken over by a greater power, and the idea of a Bohemian autonomous kingdom was gone forever. Well, at least until the First Republic.
For 300 years.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of consequences with this, but the big deal were the 27 noblemen that they needed to make an example of. And that example was harsh.
So they were tortured for some 9 months. They were, which, you know, try to picture that for a minute. I mean, that's pretty harsh.
Can you tell us some of the torture techniques, Travis, about what they might have done?
Well, I'm not sure about what they did in those chambers precisely. I mean, there's a wide range of torture devices from the time period, so we can guess. One that comes to mind that I remember it because it's particularly gruesome is called the Swedish wheel, and they strap you in to a huge wheel, and at the bottom of the vat is basically boiling oil. So think of like a deep fryer.
Yeah.
And just the way they strap you in, you know, this can involve the rack, which is, you know, stretching your bones, breaking your bones, whatever. And then they, you know, so you have this, you're in a wheel, you're turning around in circles. So you have this quiet reprieve when you're in the top, although full of pain. And then they dip you down into this vat of, you know, boiling water, boiling oil, rather. So you're slowly being cooked alive. Eventually, your skin just kind of falls off, and you don't last very long.
Some of the really tough stories that you hear about the torturing, just the base horrible parts of being of being a bad human to it, and doing horrible things to another human being, were just part of the daily issues of what happened for medieval torture. And if you were got caught, you'd prefer a quick death, and that wasn't granted to you. One of the things it would do would be able to take you and put you up on a harness, take your clothes completely off, and they would lower you onto a sharpened pyramid to a certain orifice. And the idea is, yes, the weight of your body would probably do a lot of damage, of course, and cause internal bleeding. Which would be something that would maybe speed death a little bit faster. But really the unfortunate ones were the ones that contracted, got very sick actually from the bacteria because they did not clean these devices from their previous torture victims. So it was one of those things where you got sick from an infection more likely, which meant a longer prolonged death. Mm-hmm. This is hard stuff to listen to. It's hard stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
If you're of the type of person that wants to come in and learn about these torture things to say, okay, let's not repeat this as a historical reminder.
Let's not give anybody any ideas.
Right. Let's not give anybody ideas, but let's also look at why we can't ever go back to this again. There are several places in Prague in Old Town. One in particular is kind of a tourist trap, but it's a museum of torture. They do explain a lot of this stuff, and they do show them people with the actual devices that were used in underground Prague. So it's something that will keep you up at night when you think about it. And I'm sure giving these tours to a lot of tourists, that's something that they had taken with them back home to the respective countries as something they did not know, but wish to probably forget. But it's one thing that kind of gets me for these 27 noblemen and the losing cause was the end of the torture. Let's say they all made it because there was an edict that they could not be tortured to death because they needed them for a public showing. And if you walk around just to the right of the clock tower where there's kind of an open space, there's a little plaza connected to the great square there, and you will see 27 white crosses that are made of little blocks of stone that are there to represent these 27 noblemen. That's exactly where the big platform, the scaffolds were, where they met their demise.
And I would say most tourists don't know that, because I mean, there's 27 crosses, there's the date, the 21st of June 1621, the summer solstice, and there's two executioner symbols, the cross swords.
Cross swords, yeah.
But there's nothing else. Maybe there's a Czech plaque, you know, but tourists just wander right over that without knowing what that is, per se.
It's kind of surreal. I mean, everyone's either drinking their pivo, beer, or having, you know, an ice cream cone, right at one of the more gruesome parts of Czech history.
Yeah, where the scaffolds were for a long time.
But maybe, Travis, you can tell our listeners on this podcast that how these guys met their fate was all had a message to it. Mm-hmm. And the executioner did his best with a sharpened sword to a certain point to make their heads heads come off a lot easier.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. So to our eyes, this doesn't sound like
humane.
Something nice
no.
or humane. However, the executioner, and we'll get into who he was in a different podcast, possibly with the second defenestration. But just the execution itself is very interesting because it was noted, including in the English language. I mean, there was a kind of a diplomat for you know, from the UK at the time, from England rather, and you know, he even describes that first of all, the executioner always wore a red mask. This time, he wore a black mask to show sympathy, and you know, we can
sympathy towards who?
Towards the 27 being executed.
The Protestants.
Uh-huh. And right. Okay. Exactly, yeah, we can get into his whole life and everything, and he has a fascinating life, the executioner, I mean. But yeah, he was Protestant, as were the 27 noblemen. And so he showed sympathy that way. He also, this is a gruesome little tidbit, but if the executioner did not pity you, like let's say you're a murderer or a rapist, and the executioner felt like you deserved your punishment, then they would often purposefully use a rusty, kind of dull blade. There's one instance of someone in Serbia living for another 24 hours after his beheading. So it was blunt enough that, you know, he kind of took a couple of whacks at it, but the guy survived this for another day. So, I mean that's, you know, worst-case scenario, so imagine that. You know, it could be more than one hacks. But in this case, it was noted that the executioner, his name was Jan Midlarsch, which is John Miller, I guess, if you want to be technical about it. But Jan Midlarsch, that it was actually noted that he had multiple razor-sharp swords. And now this is strange to our ears, but it was noted that when he chopped off Jan Jesenius's head, that it just went whoosh, one swipe and went sailing into the air, which was a clear sign of sympathy, which is strange to us, I'm sure.
And we know this, by the way, from letters, correspondence in English that were written towards the monarch in England at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, this was a big showing, not to just to show everyone in Bohemia don't rise up against the Catholic Church or the powers to be in Austria, but this is for Europe to see. And so they had a lot of diplomats and people representing different kingdoms here at that time in 1621 to witness all this happening. And I also heard that if you actually were one of the 27 noblemen that actually had a weapon in your hand at Bilahora, at the Battle of Bilahora, they'd tuck off your hands first.
Yeah.
Before they took the decapitation.
Yeah, so, Jan Jesenius, because he was kind of the leader of the group, let's say the speaker, they cut out his tongue first. And another thing that was noted is that apparently, you can take this with a grain of salt, but apparently Jan Midlarsch, so the executioner actually went up to Jan Jesenius and asked him for his forgiveness before he did this. And, you know, Jan Jesenius answered something to the effect of, you know, you got to do what you got to do. And so he cut off his tongue, then cut off his head. Then some of these actors, like you said, the ones that actually picked up arms, they cut off their arms before being beheaded. Then 24 out of the 27, I believe it was, or 23 out of the 27 were beheaded. Another three or four, I don't remember the numbers exactly, but another three The emperor decided they deserved death, but not that their blood be shed. So they were hung from the scaffolds above where the other guys were beheaded. It's the window is still there. It's actually one of the windows that's halfway missing. It's you can still see that window where the scaffolds would hang out of. And then the last guy, he was just a secretary of sorts, and he begged for his life, saying, you know, he's not nobility, he didn't do anything. So the emperor spared his life, but because he begged so much, because he flapped his tongue so much, he nailed him by his tongue to the scaffolds and left him there. That's not the end of the story. Then they took
I wish it were. They took
Anyasinius's tongue, nailed it to his head, and they took 12 of the top leaders and put their heads in a metal cage and hung it from Charles Bridge for 10 years.
That was not uncommon for these times because they would basically warn anybody coming in the city. This is what happens to you if you're convicted of treason.
Yep.
And they would do this in England quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, this is the same time period where they would put you in a cage and just let you starve to death publicly. So it's not uncommon, but it was a clear sign that, you know, don't try this again. Bohemia no longer exists as a political entity, you know, and all hail the Habsburg overlords.
There were many things that were coming the way towards Bohemia at the time because of this, and it was something that the Czechs never really forgot. It was a benchmark in their history. And moving forward, we see that it's unfortunately not the first or last time that the shadows of other countries or other entities would come over the Czech people and the Czech lands. We would have Nazi occupation. We would have the communist regime. And people at some point still tried to hold on to what it meant to be Czech, what it means to be Czech. And that's something that I think that the people here are still struggling to figure that out.
But even Nazis and communists had roles to play regarding the underground.
They did. During the resistance, one thing that you would think when you heard about the Czechs being taken over and became a protectorate, if you will, from the Third Reich, they were just basically – the lands were just given away by other European powers, specifically Great Britain, basically signed on over to Hitler to appease him. Of course, that didn't work out with Poland, and we had the Second World War.
Right.
One of the big things, though, is that the Czechs did not roll over. Some did capitulate. Some did feel that they were closer to the German Empire, especially if you live closer to the border.
Well, at the time,
especially a lot of connections with the German people pre-World War I. But when we get to the 1930s, the winds of war were blowing, and people knew exactly what was going to happen. And I think to the chagrin of everybody else around the world, it was just too late to do anything. The Czech resistance did fight. They fought very, very hard. And in future podcasts, we'll talk about Operation Anthropod, and we'll talk about the assassination of Heydrich. To get an idea about what these folks did and how they hid in the city of Prague, you have to again look underneath the city.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these horrible stories of places of torture chambers became avenues of freedom in a lot of ways.
Sure.
To hide away from the Germans. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So those things are all underneath the city, and they're just wonderful bits of history for those of you that are thirsty for knowledge of Central Europe and Prague and the Czech Republic. So if you ever do come to Prague to visit, you're going to have to take these tours. You're going to have to start asking questions. There'll be people and organizations more than happy to take your money to show you around. But it's worth it. I think it's definitely an interesting tour to take.
I would encourage the ghost tours. I was actually particularly like a ghost tour guide, and that's kind of it's the darker parts, but maybe the most interesting ones. I don't know.
Well, before we wrap up tonight, I definitely want to kind of go over a little bit more of maybe the modern day underground that we talk about with Prague. One of the beautiful things about living here is the metro system that they have here. People, they do drive.
Which it still ties into the communist era.
In a
fantastic way.
Yeah, well, please tell our audience about that, because that is interesting.
So there's three metro lines. They're planning a fourth, but if you take the Green Line, Especially right downtown. That's the one that you take to go downtown, like museum, you know, the main area we're talking about here. If you'll notice, it is very far underground. Namesti Miru, which means like peace square or square of peace, is the escalator is 113 meters long. So, you know, to people that aren't used to that, 113 meters is like 300 feet.
That's very close. Our American audience might know this from Washington, D.C., near the National Zoo.
Yeah.
It's about the same length
as that.
It's very disheartening to get on it, and you can't even see daylight as you're going up.
Well, but there's a reason for that, because not all the lines are like that. You know, some of them are normal, but, they're so far underground because it was designed as a fallout shelter
during the Cold War.
And there's a couple of interesting little kind of facts there. One I'll mention is that in 2002 there was a flood. It was an epic flood, kind of infamous. It flooded all of downtown. Well, one of the side effects was around the metro station Mustek, which is, again, right on, you know, Wenceslas Square. It's the one you would get off to maybe go to Old Town Square or the main Wenceslas Square there. But around that area, coffins started floating up.
Coffins,
yeah. And people started freaking out.
I didn't know there was a cemetery.
Neither did I. Well, there's the Jewish cemetery is pretty close, but it wasn't there, and people started freaking out, thinking a cemetery somewhere, you know, got loose, and you know the dirt got loose, and the coffins floated to the top. But it turned out pretty quickly that the coffins were empty, and then someone remembered that down in the metro in the subway is some old fallout shelter rooms full of old supplies like canned foods, radio equipment, and even in case of death, empty coffins, a whole room full of them. So they just kind of floated up to the top. And another kind of interesting thing is that after the Cold War ended, turns out that the whole fallout shelter thing was mostly, I don't know what to call it, propaganda. They did a couple of quick studies and said that the ventilation was horrible. If even like 50 to 100,000 people went down there, which is, you know, 5 to 10% of the population of Prague, everyone just would have suffocated pretty quickly. There's no way to survive a nuclear winter or any kind of anything down there, you know, more than a couple hours. I mean, it's a bomb shelter, but not a fallout shelter.
Interesting. Yeah. There's many stories like that back in the States of during the Cold War, of turning your backyard into a bomb shelter. Or
yep.
My favorite is during the time my father would tell me that they would tell, and these sirens go off in school, and they would all hide under their desk, like that would stop.
A
nuclear explosion. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. We've learned a lot, haven't we?
Cover yourself in wet newspaper.
Exactly. Yeah. You'll be okay,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure.
We really wanted to give our audience just a taste tonight, because in the future podcast that we're going to have for Bohemian Podcast, we're going to be traveling not just throughout just parts of Prague, but all of Prague. And we're going to give you an idea of different times, different eras, about this wonderful place of Central Europe that we've chosen to make our homes and raise our families. And I think that I don't know if I can speak for you, Travis. I do miss the States, and I do appreciate being an American. But being over here is such a unique experience.
Yeah.
This is a great time to be here in Prague. We're 20 plus years after the revolution,
mm-hmm.
and things have changed so much it's not so much of a giant culture shock. But if we do have, if we do experience that, we'll be talking about that on the show as well.
Uh huh. It's changed a lot. Even I've been here 7 years, almost 8 years, and it's changed a lot in that time. Even so, some of the folks that have been here in the '90s, it's a different world.
It's a different place.
Isn't it?
Well, you know, I think that's probably a great place for us to hold to stop for tonight. We would like you to check out bohemikin.podhoster.com for the latest episodes that we'll be putting together online, as well as subscribe on iTunes. Blog that I have at bohemikin.com. You can check out what I'm up to here in Prague. Again, we won't just be focusing on Prague every week. We're going to be spreading out, man. I spent a lot of time this summer looking at some wonderful places in Český Krumlov, in Moravia.
Oh, yeah.
Been down in Šumava, down in the southern part near Austria. There's just one amazing thing after another across this great country, and we'll try to bring that to you as well. Please make sure you send us an email. Any suggestions and requests or corrections, we'll try to do the best we can. You can also find that email at bohemican.com to get back to us as well, and we would love to hear from you.
Yep. And check out our sister podcast called History of Alchemy at historyofalchemy.podhoster.com. Or historyofalchemy.com for – it's more of a wiki than a blog, but kind of interesting stuff. There's some pretty interesting Czech alchemists that we get into. And again, it's me and Pete hosting that one. So we'll be back every 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
Thanks so much. Take care.